funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did Mohandas Gandhi's passion for protecting the downtrodden and powerless evolve over time, and what disappointments went hand in glove with his greatest triumphs? When Gandhi moved to South Africa in 1893, he was a young London-educated law graduate hired to help deal with a lawsuit between two Indian-owned trading firms. The job was supposed to last less than a year. Instead, he became engaged in the fight for Indian civil rights in South Africa and remained there for more than 20 years before returning to his native India to work for self-rule, local economic independence, Muslim-Hindu unity, and an end to the devastating practice of untouchability. Joseph Lelieveld is a former correspondent and executive editor for the New York Times and a winner of the Pulitzer Prize. He writes about Gandhi's evolution as a man and as a political and spiritual leader in his new book, Great Soul, Mahatma Gandhi and His Struggle with India. Joe, welcome to Think.
Oh, thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
Your career as a foreign correspondent for the Times took you both to South Africa and also India. How did living in those places affect your interest in the story of Gandhi?
Well, my interest was first pricked when I visited Gandhi's settlement outside Durban in the province of Natal in South Africa. And there were some descendants of Gandhi still living there, but basically it was a monument, just the houses that he and his followers had inhabited and the printing press they used to turn out a weekly newspaper. And that sort of put an image in my mind of Gandhi in Africa. I could see across the valley to various Zulu settlements and picture the life he had led there. Then my next assignment, by sheer coincidence, was India. Actually, I was kicked out of South Africa at that time. And I shortly thereafter went to India, and it happened to be near Gandhi's centenary year, so all sorts of celebrations were in train. And I started putting together notes for an article on what remained of Gandhi's influence in India. Now, this is a long time ago. This is about 40 years ago. And so I got a little deeper into that, and I walked around portions of India with some of his followers who were still campaigning on for social equality. But I came away with the impression that while India revered Gandhi and considered him the father of the nation and praised him for instilling a spirit of fearlessness in the people who struggled for India's freedom, it did not really heed in his lifetime or now 20 years, this was then 20 years after his death, his most urgent social teachings. And so that was a part of what I wrote at that time. Now, that's a long time ago, and I went on to many other experiences as a correspondent and editor, but that stuck in the back of my mind. And when I stepped down from editing and started getting into book writing, I thought of that again and thought about ways to approach that theme. And the result is this book.
What you've given us here, Joe, is a very honest portrait of a human being with extraordinary strengths and ideals, but also some very human flaws. Did you find that sort of balance lacking in other works that you read about Gandhi?
No, I don't mean to criticize. There's a great body of material on Gandhi, both for the general public and academic studies. And in some ways, I write on the backs of those authors, but I mean this to be a supplementary essay, in a sense. Most people celebrate the independence movement and talk about Gandhi's role in all the agitation and negotiation that eventually led to India's freedom and India's partition and all that went with that. And they touch on, but don't dwell on, the subject that looking at, which is Gandhi's, I would say, largely unsuccessful but determined and consistent effort to bring about a kind of social transformation in India. On the issues you mentioned, he believed very strongly that the Hindu majority should accommodate the large Muslim minority. Uh, he He was strong on the question of untouchability, and in his mind, that was connected to some considerable degree with a question of public sanitation, the fact that there were people's sweepers, they're euphemistically called, whose job was basically to remove the filth and, let's put it metaphorically, the night soil that Indians were accustomed to depositing in public places out of doors. And so public sanitation became a great cause for him. He felt very strongly about mass rural poverty. That has something to do with the change in his own dress, his stripping down to wearing a loincloth and a shawl rather than this man who had once been a well-attired, suited lawyer in Johannesburg, was now walking around like a Hindu holy man. And he said, his explanation for that was, we must dress the poorest before we dress ourselves.
It's ironic that his first act of civil disobedience had to do with refusing to remove his turban.
Yes. I don't know that he thought of it as an act of civil disobedience at the time, but it showed how much a part of his character that was. He was in a Durban courtroom. It was his very first day in South Africa. He was a non-entity. Basically, nobody knew who he was, although he had been trained as a barrister, a courtroom lawyer in London. And he walked in wearing this turban, and the judge said, "Take it off." The judge viewed it as a mark of disrespect to come in with your head covered. Gandhi then wrote a letter to the newspaper saying, "That's not disrespect. That's the way Indians show respect." And that was his first conflict in South Africa. And it, to my mind, it shows the fire that was in him from the start.
And almost from the moment he arrived in South Africa, he was struck by the fact that although Indians were supposed to be British subjects, they were not treated with the same respect as white South Africans.
That's right. He had an argument based on a proclamation of Queen Victoria when she was proclaimed Empress of India in 1858, I believe. She spoke about the equality of her subjects. And so his argument was, that doesn't just apply to India, that applies to the whole empire, and since we're from India, we're British Indians, and should be treated as the equal of whites in South Africa. It's an argument that ultimately went nowhere, but it led to his first kind of epiphany on the subject of social equality. He wrote a little pamphlet, one of his first political writings, in which he argued for equality for Indians and the fact that they came from an ancient culture and were civilized people. And there was a retort in a Johannesburg newspaper, obviously written by an Englishman, that said, "What's this about equality for Indians? They don't treat one another equally. And Gandhi realized, of course, that's true. Caste system was a hierarchy of social status, and the outcasts were treated with a total lack of respect, almost an epitome of inequality. So for him, it's a kind of blinding insight, although it might have been obvious. It's not something that would have happened to him in quite that way in India. And it's the beginning of Gandhi becoming Gandhi.
I think this is interesting. He himself was a Hindu, but he was representing, when he first went to South Africa, a Muslim firm. Did he already have particularly enlightened views about religious harmony at that point in his life?
I think he probably did. He was something of a religious seeker. His time in London had almost nothing to do with the politics of the period, but a lot to do with religion. He met some evangelical Christians. He got involved with a mystical cult that was popular in the late Victorian age called Theosophy, in which attracted a number of English adherents. And that introduced him to a culturally mixed society. And he worked his way towards a view that, kind of universalist view, that all religions basically had at their heart the same truths, and that therefore all religions should be valued. But what the thing you put your finger on is very important. Here is a higher caste Hindu who becomes a sort of mouthpiece for the small Muslim trading class in South Africa, and as this kind of shades into a political career, he finds himself delivering his first political speeches to largely Muslim audiences in mosques. That could never have happened in India, and it shaped the way he viewed relations between these two large communities in India, and has something to do with the fact that when he got it back to India, he early on sought alliances with Muslims and rose to the leadership of the national movement with enormous Muslim support.
So we remember Gandhi for his nonviolent principles, but in fact he served with the British Army in the Second Boer War, and he also helped with the quelling of a Zulu uprising in 1906.
Yes, those were non-combatant roles as a leader of a group of Indian stretcher bearers, but the 1906 one, and those were meant to be a demonstration that, yes, we are equal citizens of the empire, that same argument. This is before he's talking about Indian independence. But we're ready to bear the responsibilities of equal citizenship. So we'll go, when you go to war, we'll go to war with you, although nonviolently. In this Zulu Rising, which was a very repressive business by the white colonialists, quite brutal in its later stages when they burned Zulu villages and just pretty much beat up and thrashed any young Zulu who could be characterized as a warrior, Gandhi found himself and his small detachment of Indian stretcher bearers basically treating the Zulus, which was, in traditional caste terms, they were untouchables, but they actually tended to their wounds. And Gandhi kind of realized at this point that he'd been on the wrong side in this struggle, that this was a very repressive thing. He was revolted by the brutality he saw. It really wasn't a war at that point. It was just a campaign of suppression. And it led very directly to major turning point in Gandhi's life, perhaps the major turning point in Gandhi's life. Within a few weeks of that Zulu campaign, he takes a vow of celibacy, which is not unknown in Indian religious tradition. He, by then, had been married for over 20 years. He was the father of four sons, but he vows to be celibate for the rest of his life. And there is a kind of belief in some aspects of the Hindu tradition that a person who does this gains spiritual and physical strength.
Let me have you pause there.
The act of sex diminishes one's spiritual and physical strength. Gandhi believed that, and he took that vow. And then, hard upon that, there is a piece of legislation
Joe, let me have you pause there. I apologize, but we have to take a break here. Joseph Lelyveld is my guest. His new book is called Great Soul, Mahatma Gandhi and His Struggle with India. You can join the conversation now by calling in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, an evening graduate program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Joseph Lelyveld, former correspondent and executive editor for The New York Times. His new book is called Great Soul, Mahatma Gandhi and His Struggle with India. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. So, Joe, you were telling us about this vow of celibacy that Gandhi took, and I guess his wife did not object to this?
There's no record of what her response was. He just assumed she would welcome it. And buried in that is a view of sexual intimacy as being perhaps a brutal thing that men do to women, but the psychoanalyst Erik Erikson, who wrote a very great book called Gandhi's Truth 40 years ago, would contend. I am not a psychoanalyst, but I'm satisfied to just say that this is not out of the Indian religious tradition. What he then did, though, was he had another vow almost simultaneously. Legislation was passed to restrict Indian immigration to the area around Johannesburg, which was the seat of the burgeoning gold mining industry and of commerce in South Africa. And the Indians in that area met to protest it. They were being ordered to register if they wanted to stay in that area, and they were promising not to register in an act of civil disobedience. And Gandhi took a vow that night in the same terms, with the same kind of religious intensity, that he took the vow of celibacy privately just shortly earlier, and that's the beginning, although the word wasn't used, of his campaigns of satyagraha, which gave the world the idea of nonviolent resistance and struggle.
Why did he fail to identify with the plight of black South Africans, even as he was developing an understanding that Indians ought to be united regardless of caste?
I think that first of all, the black political organizations had not come into being yet. They were just beginning. And because his argument was so much tied to this business of being British Indians, it left no place for blacks. Nobody talked of British Africans. But it's a failing. It's a failure of imagination. As time goes on, because he lived there for 21 years, it becomes clear that he understands what the ultimate struggle in South Africa will have to be, and that one day blacks will assert the undeniable claim for their rights. But he doesn't embrace that. At the time, he seems to be saying, that's not our struggle. I think there are all kinds of calculations, none of them that make his stance understandable, but don't necessarily cast great credit on him. One is that Indians were not without their own color consciousness, and the idea that we should struggle with Africans for equal rights for all people in this land would have been a hard sell in his own community, his own small community. While he met some of the emerging African leaders, he didn't know them well. And they had their own feelings about Indians at that time, that Indians were people who were coming in, here talking about the merchant class, people who were coming in and exploiting us, along with the whites. So it just didn't happen. And his understanding of what was going on in South Africa, I think, got refined over time, and he learned to express himself in clearer and better terms. But it's partly the age, and it's partly his own commitments to his own people, and it's got to be said, a blind spot.
Help us understand this, Joe. Why would Indians have emigrated to South Africa to work as indentured servants when they were treated as second-class citizens? Was the economic opportunity still better in South Africa than it was for them at home?
These were the poorest landless laborers from village India in the main. They were recruited with great promises. One of the promises, interestingly enough, that was used quite cynically was, if you go to this new country, you can escape the caste system. This was addressed to lower caste people or outcasts. A picture was presented of how this would lead to economic security. But these were people who basically had no work where they lived and were on the very edge of survival. So there was no shortage of volunteers. They came, though, under these five-year contracts that made them virtual slaves for that period. And most Indians in South Africa trace their ancestry back to these indentured laborers. They were about a third of the community when Gandhi arrived were people living under these articles of indenture, and many of the others were people who had sort of graduated and settled in South Africa in a very tenuous kind of legal status.
So during the latter part of his time in South Africa, Gandhi developed an extremely close relationship with a German architect named Hermann Kohlenbach. Can you talk about what drew them to one another?
This is what got writing about this is what got me in trouble. You know, my book
is banned
has been banned in one
several
Indian
states.
And,
yeah.
It's now been published in India and is selling well and getting a good reception. But due to inaccurate reports of what the book actually said about the Kallenbach relationship, the word got out that I had written that Gandhi was bisexual. I don't reach any conclusion of that sort. What I did do was discuss whether there was anything sexual about the relationship. I concluded that it was, in fact, celibate, that they weren't hypocrites. But a lot of their discussion with one another had to do with how you repress physical urges. Mm-hmm. Anyway, Gandhi moved, living in Johannesburg, started living with this man, Kallenbach. His wife was now down in near Durban, and they lived together for nearly 4 years. And there was a long correspondence over these years, especially when they were physically separated. And Gandhi's letters, which occupy nearly the whole of a volume in his collected writings, are, I think, can fairly be characterized as love letters. It was a deep and emotional attachment. And that doesn't mean it was sexual. Maybe it's harder in our day to think of such an intimate relationship between two men as not sexual than it was then, but I was just trying to make the point that Kallenbach was an extremely important figure in his life, and I document that point by quoting Gandhi's letters to Kallenbach. Kallenbach wrote to Gandhi too, but Gandhi destroyed his letters, thinking that his friend had asked him to. Whether he expected Kallenbach to destroy his letters is not clear. They didn't become public until decades after both men were dead, and it's less than 20 years ago that they came into the public domain. So I'm the first one to use this material extensively in a book for the general public, and that shocked a lot of people, and it shocked people, I guess, that I was raising the question of sex in relationship to the Mahatma. But I did not pursue it to the point of claiming he was bisexual.
Do you think the concern for people is not whether or not their relationship was in fact physically intimate, but the idea that Gandhi may have been attracted to another man? Is that what upsets people?
I can't really read that. The people who got very upset were people who hadn't read the book.
It's always the way, isn't it?
What they're upset about is three or four paragraphs in a discussion of 10 or 12 pages of this very interesting relationship. I think any fair reading would find compelling reasons to look at this, but I can't. I think there's a certain amount of political opportunism involved here too. The man who banned the book in the state of Gujarat, which happens to be Gandhi's home part of the country, Chief Minister is perhaps the most polarizing figure in Indian politics. His name is Narendra Modi, and he is not generally seen as an exponent of Gandhian values. Gandhi was for nonviolence. He was for Hindu-Muslim harmony, and Modi is widely blamed for terrible violence against Muslims that occurred 15 or 20 years ago, and for building his career on a kind of Hindu supremacist platform that was almost the opposite of what Gandhi represented. So to have Narendra Modi step forward and denounce the book is, I think, it's not for me to interpret it, in many Indian minds, something of a travesty, and that gave rise to the controversy. It ultimately led to a kind of rent-a-crowd demonstration in New Delhi, a tiny demonstration with people walking around with placards saying I should be hung, and one had a picture of me with my head in a noose. But I don't think this was a serious threat. I just think was an example of a version of our talk radio manifested on the streets of New Delhi.
Joe, so many great leaders of the 20th century were influenced by Gandhi's principles. He himself was greatly influenced by Leo Tolstoy.
Absolutely. Tolstoy, at the end of his life, became a kind of radical Christian prophet, denouncing all the institutions of Tsarist Russia, including the church, as hypocritical, and denouncing the class system as it existed in Tsarist Russia. Much of what he said seemed to Gandhi to be very applicable to India's situation and to his own religious quest. So Gandhi, I think that was an important turning in Gandhi's life when he unwrapped that book, The Kingdom of God is Within You, and you can see that he adopted some of the language there and made some of the concepts there his own over the years to come.
Was it the 1913 passage of the head tax in South Africa that officially caused Gandhi to understand himself, to view himself as a representative of every Indian seeking equality as opposed to simply those of higher castes?
Well, actually, it wasn't. The tax had existed since the 1890s, and he had opposed it. And he had fought for the elimination of the tax on women, but he had never... This was a tax that was really intended to drive the no longer indentured Indians, people coming off indenture, out of the country, because it was a heavy tax given their livelihoods and too much for most of them to pay. And a small movement began in Natal, this province where Durban is and where most Indians were, to get the head tax abolished. Gandhi was actually slow. I think the book shows that Gandhi was actually slow to identify himself with that movement. And he was living in Johannesburg in a different part of the country, and he just didn't get involved at first, although appeals were made to him to support it. But then, quite suddenly, he embraces it. And and plots a campaign that would involve these so-called coolies, these indentured laborers. And that becomes his first really mass movement campaign. In 1913, in his last year in South Africa, he leads thousands of indentured laborers out on strikes from the coal mines in Natal province, and ultimately from the sugar plantations. And they go on a march, and they enter the Transvaal, the area that they were barred from entering. There were all these rules against internal migration by Indians specifically in South Africa, and they, in a nonviolent way, as a demonstration of civil disobedience, they break those rules, and they walk across the border of the Transvaal, and they march towards Johannesburg under Gandhi's leadership. He's ultimately arrested, but it's a watershed in the use of civil disobedience tactics on a mass level, and it's the culmination of Gandhi's time in South Africa.
So what made him decide it was time to go back to India?
Well, all along I think he'd been intending to, and his profile in India gradually kept rising because of his leadership in South Africa. They were dimly aware of what was happening. These struggles were covered, you know, by the news agencies of the time. And Gandhi was gaining a name, although he wasn't present in India, as being a promising leader. And he was embraced as such by one of the leading political figures of the time in India, who actually visited South Africa, and urged him to come back, which he was ready to do at that point. He also had taken the Indian struggle in South Africa as far as he could, because the whites weren't going to give up any more than they gave up in the final compromise.
Let me have you stop there. Excuse me. We're going to take another quick break. My guest this hour is Joseph Lelieveld, former executive editor of the New York Times and author of the new book Great Soul, Mahatma Gandhi and His Struggle with India. Join us by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, an evening graduate program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Joseph Lelieveld, former correspondent and executive editor of the New York Times and author of the new book Great Soul, Mahatma Gandhi and His Struggle with India. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. I want to talk just for a second here about your title, since we're moving into the time that Gandhi returned to India. You call it Struggle with India rather than for India, and this really is a key sort of moment in the book or sense in the book that India never did exactly what Gandhi was hoping it would do, despite his really earnest fight for his four pillars.
India embraced him very quickly. It revered him. It almost, at some points, even deified him.
Mm-hmm.
He had to protest that he was of this earthy to get away from this idolization of him, but India didn't listen very closely to him on what he thought were the most urgent social issues it faced. These things we've been talking about: untouchability, the status of Muslims, and the whole question of rural mass poverty. And Gandhi, what moves me about Gandhi is what I call his moral ambition. Gandhi just doesn't give up. He's not satisfied with political leadership and political success. And periodically in his career in India, he would withdraw from active politics to concentrate in his own way on these issues, usually without great success, but making huge efforts, even as a very old man, away from the limelight, and trying to set an inspirational example, and recognizing as time goes on that he's not getting where he wants to get, and at times being on the edge of despair over that, when India's freedom is declared in August 1947, Gandhi stays away from the celebrations, and he refuses to be interviewed on the radio. He says, "This is a sorry affair."
Because of the partition.
Yeah, not just because of the partition, because of the violence, and because of the absence of the kind social transformation that he had been hoping to see, the kind of unification of all these various conflicting communities into one harmonious Indian people who are really concerned about one another. It was in some ways a utopian vision, but it was Gandhi's vision. And I try to argue in this book that anybody who's still struggling in India on these issues, bearing on social equality, and there are, of course, people who do, is apt to be inspired by the example and teachings of Gandhi.
I'm curious about how he formed relationships with other justice activists, because it would seem in some ways like there would have been a natural alliance with the Muslim League leader, Muhammad Ali Jinnah, with B.R. Ambedkar, who, of course, represented the untouchable caste. But those relationships never really coalesced.
Yeah, and I think partly it's that Gandhi is a national leader. Had to maintain his status with caste Hindus, who were in fact the majority, and was always doing something of a balancing act, and they wanted to see more. Jinnah is an interesting figure because his background is, from a certain point of view, is quite like Gandhi's. He's also from Gujarat. He's also a lawyer trained in London, but Jinnah is very secular. And he's offended by Gandhi's bringing religion into politics and using religion to advance his cause. Jinnah is at first not attracted to mass politics. The paradox is that 20 years after Gandhi rises to leadership, Jinnah uses very much the same methods and appeals in a Muslim context that Gandhi had been using. And it works for him, and he suddenly emerges as the leader of the Muslims. But no, they did not find common ground, and there is something about Gandhi. You know, he's so inner directed. He says he can only listen to his inner voice. He says he is guided by the truth, meaning the truth as he sees it. That makes compromise difficult, and I try to go through the stages of his relationship with Ambedkar, which I think is pivotal in some ways in Gandhi's life, and has a lot to do with the way he spends his energies for at least the decade of the 1930s and beyond, and they come close to agreement, but it doesn't hold. I don't think the blame can be by any means put entirely on Ambedkar, but they were each subjected to very different pressures. Ambedkar wanted to make it possible for untouchables, now who are now called Dalits, to escape the stereotypes of the caste system, and to thrive in an urban environment and to enter the professions and government service and to rise in the society. Gandhi was very focused on village India, where the majority of the population lived. Ambedkar thought the villages were a hopeless place for his people, but of course it's where most of his people lived then and do live now. So neither quite embraced the whole truth. And there are people today who argue that they were complementary, but they didn't find that complementary common ground in their own lives.
To what extent did Gandhi feel like the deification of him that you mentioned earlier got in the way of what he was trying to do?
Well, he certainly didn't encourage it. And sometimes you can see that he was almost repulsed by it. But on the other hand, he realized that these rituals of mass worship were politically useful. So he didn't always spurn it either. This is in India, you have to realize, before mass communications. There were no radios in the villages. Obviously, there was no television or anything like that, no Twitter. And yet, somehow, the word that there was now a leader who cared for the poorest people in a kind of new and different way communicated itself to across India in a remarkably short time. And Gandhi, who had never faced a crowd bigger than 5,000 or 6,000 in South Africa, was now finding crowds wherever he went of 25,000, 50,000, 100,000, even 500,000, massing to hear him. They couldn't hear him because there weren't adequate amplification systems, but just to glimpse him, to see him as a speck on the horizon, meant a great deal to Indians, and that had a lot to do with the power that Gandhi amassed and the kind of response he got when he called his nonviolent struggles. But it also was something of a burden because he knew he wasn't, in the deepest sense, communicating his values to that widely.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll go to the phones now and speak with Sri in Louisville. Hi, Sri.
Hi. I had a question, especially really more of a comment to make on Gandhi as a father. I was watching a movie recently that's called Gandhi, My Father, and that's based on his oldest son.
Harilal
Gandhi. And how throughout his life he and his father clashed on their ideals, the ideals that they shared. And to a certain extent, the movie almost portrayed that Harilal's failed life was a direct effect of Gandhi not having lived up to his parental duties. And I was wondering if you had a comment to make on that.
Thanks for your call. Well, what do you think, Joe?
Harilal Gandhi's life is a tragic life. He tries very hard to be an obedient son and to follow his father. He went to jail, I forget the number, but an incredible number of times in South Africa during the South African campaigns, I think more than a dozen, and spent cumulatively several years in jail. But he never quite got the recognition he wanted from Gandhi, and Gandhi at first disapproved of his marriage because Gandhi wanted him to become what Gandhi had become, a celibate, selfless servant of the poor. And Harilal wanted to have the opportunities that Gandhi, as a younger man, had had, both in his private life and in a professional life. So there was a kind of father-son struggle there and ultimately, the thing that sends Harilal on a downward spiral is less Gandhi's harshness, although Gandhi was certainly harsh with him, than the tragic fact that his a wife he deeply loved died at an early age, and so he becomes a drinker and an alcoholic, and ultimately he really, just to provoke and embarrass his father, he converts to Islam, and the whole downward spiral of Harilal Gandhi is a very sad leitmotif of Gandhi's life. And Gandhi understands it because at various times he tries to explain what is happening, And he's able to explain it in Hari Lal's terms. He's able to say that he feels that I haven't been generous with him, and that I, you know, and he's not defensive about this. They just do not achieve a meeting of minds. And as it goes on over the decades, it's a pathetic story.
At the end of his own life, did Gandhi consider himself a success, a failure, a sort of mixed bag?
That's an interesting question. I think there are certainly points at the end of his own. Gandhi said once, "I'm not a quick despairer," which is an interesting phrase, and it's true. But there were moments of despair in his life, and they were more frequent at the end of his life as India's falling apart and all the violence that accompanied partition. And he says things like, "I'm a sinking ship. Who would want to sail in such a ship?" He says, "I'm a spent bullet. I'm a back number." So yes, he has those dark moments. But the thing that moves me about Gandhi, especially in the last year or two of his life, is that even when he's close to despair and he realizes that in many respects he hasn't achieved what he dreamed of achieving in the most utopian terms, he continues just sort of plodding on and going ahead, struggling for the things he had always struggled for harmony between Hindus and Muslims, against untouchability. He never gives up until the instant he's assassinated.
We just have about a minute left, but I'm curious about the difference in terms of how he's perceived today in South Africa as compared with India.
India has put him on a pedestal as the father of the nation. Now and then people feel sad that India hasn't listened to him more, but that's where he sits. South Africa is an interesting case because, when a liberation movement takes power, they need a new history. And the new South Africa, the democratic South Africa, would like to believe that all its peoples are now one. And so they need founding fathers, the way we have founding fathers of the movement. And they're legion on the African side, and there are many white liberals who had struggled for equality in South Africa. And Gandhi is now elevated in that way in South Africa as a founding father of the new South Africa because of his resistance to discriminatory white legislation because of his use of nonviolent struggle.
Afraid we're going to have to leave it there, Joe. We're out of time.
Okay,
the new book by Joseph Lelyveld is called Great Soul, Mahatma Gandhi and His Struggle with India. Joe, it's been a fascinating hour. Thank you so much for making the time for us.
You're a great interviewer. Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilufer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.